This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to TKA prosthesis design and lumbar disc herniation, which are two topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with TKA prosthesis design, and the first question reads, cementless knee replacements are associated with, and the choices are 1, increased risk for revision, 2, increased wear of the polyethylene insert, 3, increased infection risk, and 4, significantly higher knee society scores. So many published series comparing cementless to cemented knee replacements show no difference in knee society scores or infection risk, but data in several registries demonstrate a significant increase in the revision rates for cementless knees. So the correct answer to this question is 1, increased risk for revision. Although no difference in poly wear occurred, loosening of the tibial component was the most common cause of failure. Moving on to the next question. Compared to retention of the native patella in primary total knee arthroplasty, routine patellar resurfacing is associated with, and the choices are 1, no patellar complications, 2, an increased occurrence of anterior knee pain, 3, a decreased patellar fracture site, and 4, a decreased risk for revision surgery. So despite concerns regarding fracture, osteonecrosis, and patellar clunk, the routine retention of the native patella during primary total knee replacement is associated with a 20 to 30% increased revision risk in large joint registries. In addition, the retention of the native patella results in a 5.7% revision surgery rate in patients with anterior knee pain. So the correct answer to this question is 4, a decreased risk for revision surgery. Moving on to the next question. The range of knee mobility after total knee replacement is multifactorial and dependent upon implant design, surgical implantation accuracy, and patient-specific variables. What total knee implant design is associated with the most knee flexion after total knee replacement? And the choices are 1, highly conforming articular surface geometry, 2, higher flexion femoral component design manufactured to allow the most knee flexion, 3, posterior cruciate stabilized implant with or without a higher flexion manufacturing modification, and 4, posterior cruciate retaining design with a mobile bearing, custom implanted based on CT scan data. So a posterior cruciate stabilized implant has the best support in the literature in terms of the most favorable range of motion after knee arthroplasty, regardless of whether the femoral component is designed with a higher flexion variation. The higher flexion design is a manufacturing variation that is intended to increase motion by clearing the posterior condyles in flexion. Although the knees may not gain more flexion, this design allows for more safety in deep flexion. The long-term outcomes of increased stresses on the polyethylene are not known, however. By itself, a higher flexion design does not lead to increased knee mobility. The effects of mobile bearings, custom CT scan-based knee implantation, and highly conforming designs on ultimate knee range of motion are uncertain. But the correct answer to this question is 3, posterior cruciate stabilized implant with or without a higher flexion manufacturing modification. Moving on to the next question. Posterior cruciate retaining total knee arthroplasty has been studied by numerous methods, including kinematic video fluoroscopy. Which of the following is the best description of typical kinematic behavior? And the choices are 1, unpredictable anterior femoral condylar translation from full extension to 90 degrees of flexion, 2, predictable femoral rollback from full extension to 90 degrees of flexion, 3, medial femoral condyle pivot with minimal medial femoral condyle translation and lateral femoral condyle posterior translation in flexion, 4, lateral femoral condyle pivot with minimal medial femoral condyle translation, and 5, anterior tibial contact of both the medial and lateral femoral condyles in full extension. So in vivo fluoroscopic studies have enlightened orthopedic surgeons as to the actual kinematic performance of the total knee implants. Importantly, many technical factors combine to result in abnormal kinematics after total knee arthroplasty. The typical kinematics of the normal knee are negated by osteoarthritis and the various changes created by the surgeon's technique. Dennis and associates observed that anterior femoral condylar translation during deep knee flexion was most commonly observed in posterior cruciate retaining knees. So the correct answer to this question is 1, unpredictable anterior femoral condylar translation from full extension to 90 degrees of flexion. Moving on to the next question. Increasing tibial polyethylene conformity can have what effect on fixed bearing total knee arthroplasty? And the choices are 1, increased contact stress with the polyethylene, 2, increased risk of polyethylene delamination, 3, decreased mechanical forces transferred to the fixation surfaces, 4, decreased femoral rollback during flexion, and 5, increased femoral rotation during flexion. So increasing conformity between the tibial polyethylene bearing and the femoral component has desirable and undesirable consequences. Increased conformity increases the contact area and thereby reduces contact stress within the polyethylene. This can lead to less risk of polyethylene wear, fracture, and delamination. However, increasing conformity also limits the ability of the femur to roll back during flexion and may transfer increased shear stress to the fixation surfaces of the implants. So the correct answer to this question is 4, decreased femoral rollback during flexion. Moving on to the next question. An obese patient underwent a posterior cruciate ligament retaining total knee arthroplasty that has failed, and the patient is being considered for revision total knee arthroplasty. The patient also has medial collateral ligament deficiency. In selecting a revision knee prosthesis, which of the following features is considered to be essential? And the choices are 1, the ability to retain the posterior cruciate ligament, 2, a constraint mechanism that primarily resists varus valgus loads, 3, a constraint mechanism that primarily resists rotational loads, 4, femoral rollback, and 5, high conformity between the femoral and tibial articulating surfaces. So obtaining stability and proper alignment of the components is the most important aspect of knee arthroplasty. An obese patient with a deficient medial collateral ligament is at risk of exerting excessively high valgus loads on the prosthesis and may develop a valgus deformity. Therefore, the most important consideration is to use a constrained implant that incorporates inherent resistance to varus valgus loads, such as a rotating hinge design or a constrained condylar design. Constrained designs generally have conforming tibiofemoral surfaces. In such patients, retaining the posterior cruciate ligament or allowing femoral rollback are secondary concerns compared to achieving stability and maintaining alignment. So the correct answer to this question is 2, a constraint mechanism that primarily resists varus valgus loads. Moving on to the next question. Increasing articular conformity of the tibial polyethylene insert of a fixed bearing total knee arthroplasty prosthesis will have which of the following biomechanical effects? And the choices are 1, decreased contact stress within the polyethylene, 2, decreased risk of patellofemoral instability, 3, decreased risk of mechanical loosening, 4, increased risk of subsurface polyethylene cracking, and 5, increased femoral rollback during flexion. So increasing articular conformity increases the surface area for contact between the polyethylene and the femoral component. Advantages of this include lower peak contact stress within the polyethylene and less risk of polyethylene fatigue failure. Patellofemoral tracking is unchanged by increasing conformity unless gross component apposition is present. A potential disadvantage of increasing conformity includes some restriction in femoral rollback. Modest changes in conformity have not been shown to alter the rate of mechanical loosening. If conformity was increased to the extent of significant constraint, a potential increased risk of loosening would be expected, not a decrease. Design of modern TKAs include a compromise in achieving enough constraint to lower polyethylene stress without providing so much constraint as to limit kinematics and stress the fixation interfaces. So the correct answer to this question is 1, decreased contact stress within the polyethylene. Moving on to the next question, a patient is scheduled to undergo total knee arthroplasty following failure of non-surgical management. History reveals that she underwent a patellectomy as a teenager as a result of a motor vehicle accident. Examination reveals normal ligament instability. For the most predictable outcome, which of the following implants should be used? And the choices are 1, mobile bearing knee, 2, posterior cruciate ligament sparing knee, 3, posterior cruciate ligament substituting knee, 4, semi-constrained style knee, and 5, triaxial hinged knee. So Paletta and Laskins performed a retrospective study of the results of TKA with cement in 22 patients who had a previous patellectomy. 9 of the patients had insertion of a posterior cruciate ligament substituting implant. 13 patients had insertion of a posterior cruciate ligament sparing implant. The 5-year postoperative knee scores were 89 for the posterior cruciate ligament substituting knee versus 67 for the posterior cruciate ligament sparing knee with a p-value of less than 0.01. The patella functions to increase the lever arm of the extensor mechanism and to position the quadriceps tendon and the patellar ligament roughly parallel to the anterior cruciate ligament and posterior cruciate ligament respectively. The patellar ligament thereby provides a strong reinforcing structure that functions to prevent excessive anterior translation of the femur during flexion of the knee. The absence of the patella results in the patellar ligament and the quadriceps tendon being relatively in line with one another. After a patellectomy, the resultant quadriceps force is no longer parallel to the posterior cruciate ligament. This results in loss of the reinforcing function of the patellar ligament. The authors believe this loss of reinforcing function may place increased stresses on the posterior cruciate ligament and posterior aspect of the capsule, which may result in stretching of these structures over time. They found a high rate of anteroposterior instability, a high prevalence of recurvatum, and a high rate of loss of full active extension compared with passive extension in the posterior cruciate ligament sparing group, which supports their theory. So the correct answer to this question is 3. Use a posterior cruciate ligament substituting knee in a patient who had a previous patellectomy. Moving on to the next question. A patient with a documented allergy to nickel requires a total knee arthroplasty. Which of the following prostheses is most likely to provide long-term success in this individual? And the choices are 1. All polyethylene tibial component and pure titanium femoral component. 2. All polyethylene tibial component and cobalt chromium alloy femoral component. 3. Cobalt chromium alloy tibial component and cobalt chromium alloy femoral component. 4. Modular titanium tibial component and pure titanium femoral component. And 5. Modular titanium tibial component and oxidized zirconium femoral component. So nickel allergy is not an infrequent preoperative finding. The ramifications of such allergies in arthroplasty patients are poorly understood at this time. Stainless steel and cobalt chromium alloys contain relatively high concentrations of nickel. Titanium, oxidized zirconium, and polyethylene do not contain significant amounts of nickel. Titanium is not a good surface for the articulating portion of the femoral component because of its propensity for metallosis. Oxidized zirconium is the only suitable femoral component for patients allergic to nickel. A modular titanium tibial component or an all-polyethylene tibial component would be satisfactory for these patients as well. But the correct answer to this question is 5, modular titanium tibial component and oxidized zirconium femoral component. Moving on to the next question. When performing knee arthroplasty, which of the following procedures provides the most consistent fixation for the tibial component? And the choices are 1. Cementless fixation of the tibial component. 2. Augmenting cementless fixation of the tibial component with pegs or screws. 3. Cementing the metaphyseal portion and press-fitting the keel of the tibial component. 4. Cementing the metaphyseal and keel portions of the tibial component. And 5. Cemented fixation of the tibial component with screws. So all of the options except cementing the metaphyseal portion and press-fitting the keel of the tibial component have been shown to create strong and long-lasting constructs. However, cementing of both the platform and the keel offers the most predictable solution. Cementing the platform and not the keel has been shown to have a higher loosening rate than the more traditional methods of fully cementing or using screws to augment fixation. But the correct answer to this question is 4, cementing the metaphyseal and keel portions of the tibial component. Moving on to the next question, when comparing mobile bearing total knee arthroplasty to fixed bearing total condylar arthroplasty, the mobile bearing procedure provides, and the choices are 1, no improvement in survivorship, 2, approximately 15 degrees greater flexion, 3, appreciable reduction in wear rates, 4, a faster recovery profile, and 5, better quadriceps strength. So survivorship is similar in the two groups. In a recent study, mobile-bearing TKAs showed a slightly higher maximum flexion than the total condylar fixed-bearing type designs, that is 112 degrees versus 108 degrees with no difference in recovery rate. Using a fixed-bearing or a mobile-bearing design did not seem to influence the recovery rate in early results after knee arthroplasty. Mobile-bearing arthroplasties are suggested, in theory, to offer a reduction in polyethylene wear. However, clinical studies have not yet proven this. Recovery rates have yet to be statistically seen as improved with either method. Differences in strength have not been shown. Moving on to the next topic of lumbar disc herniation, the first question reads, a 46-year-old man has a recurrent disc herniation on the left side at L4-5 and has had persistent radicular symptoms for 3 months without neurologic deficit. His previous surgery was performed 13 months ago. What is the best method of surgical treatment? And the choices are 1, posterior lumbar interbody fusion, 2, anterior lumbar interbody fusion, 3, revision discectomy, 4, artificial disc replacement, and 5, interspinous process spacer. So the patient is a candidate for a revision discectomy. Outcomes of revision discectomy are nearly as good as those reported for primary discectomy. Reduction in leg pain is expected. An indication for fusion would be a concomitant instability at the planned surgical level. Though controversial, artificial disc replacement might be considered if there is a significant component of discogenic pain without instability. However, disc replacement is not the first choice of treatment in this case. Interspinous process spacers are not currently indicated in this situation. So the correct answer to this question is 3, revision discectomy. Moving on to the next question. A 42-year-old woman has a 3-week history of acute lower back pain with radiation into the left lower extremity. There is no history of trauma and no systemic symptoms are noted. Examination reveals a positive straight leg test at 25 degrees on the left side. Motor testing reveals mild weakness of the gluteus maximus and weakness of the gastrocnemius at 3 out of 5. Sensory examination reveals decreased sensation along the lateral aspect of the foot. Knee reflex is intact, however the ankle reflex is absent. MRI scans show a posterolateral disc herniation. The diagnosis at this time is consistent with the herniated nucleus pulposus at what level? And the choices are 1, L12, 2, L23, 3, L34, 4, L45, and 5, L5S1. So the patient's history and examination findings are consistent with the lumbar disc herniation at the L5S1 level. Weakness of the gastrocnemius and gluteus maximus are consistent with an S1 lumbar radiculopathy. Nerve root tension signs are also consistent with the disc herniation at L5S1, which typically affects the traversing S1 nerve root. So the correct answer to this question is 5, L5S1. Moving on to the next question. A 36-year-old man has a 2-day history of acute lower back pain with severe radicular symptoms in the left lower extremity. The patient has a positive straight leg test at 40 degrees on the left side and mild decreased sensation on the dorsum of the left foot. What is the most appropriate management at this time? And the choices are 1, urgent administration to the hospital for surgical intervention, 2, immediate MRI of the lumbar spine as an outpatient, 3, anti-inflammatory medications and activity modification, 4, caudal epidural steroid injection, and 5, electromyography. So in the absence of any severe progressive neurologic deficits or other red flags, the most appropriate management for an acute lumbar disc herniation is non-surgical care. Conservative treatments such as limited bed rest, anti-inflammatory medications, and judicious use of pain medications are appropriate in this clinical situation. Up to 90% of patients will experience a resolution of symptoms without the need for surgical intervention within a 3-month window. In the acute setting with no neurologic deficits, immediate MRI of the lumbar spine is neither beneficial nor warranted. Likewise, without signs of an acute deficit, emergent surgical intervention and caudal epidural steroid injections are not needed. But the correct answer to this question is 3, anti-inflammatory medications and activity modification. Moving on to the next question. An acute posterolateral disc herniation at the L4-5 level will most likely affect what nerve root? And the choices are 1, L3, 2, L4, 3, L5, 4, S1, and 5, S2. So posterolateral disc herniations will generally compress the traversing nerve root. Therefore, a posterolateral disc herniation at the L4-5 level will typically compromise the L5 nerve root. Far lateral or extraforaminal disc herniations generally compromise the exiting nerve root. Therefore, an extraforaminal herniation at the L4-5 level will typically compromise the exiting L4 nerve root. But the correct answer to this question is 3, the L5 nerve root. Moving on to the next question. Based on the current available best evidence, what postoperative activities should be recommended for patients undergoing first-time lumbar discectomy for disc herniation? And the choices are 1, bed rest, 2, avoidance of exercise for 6 to 8 weeks, 3, early return to low-intensity exercise, 4, early return to high-intensity exercise, and 5, gradual return to low-intensity exercise after 6 weeks. So recent evidence supports return to high-intensity exercise at 4 weeks for patients undergoing first-time lumbar discectomy for disc herniation. So the correct answer to this question is 4, early return to high-intensity exercise. Ostello et al. In a Cochrane review update demonstrated that exercise programs starting 4 to 6 weeks after surgery in patients undergoing first-time lumbar discectomy for disc herniation lead to a faster decrease in pain and disability than no rehabilitation. Additionally, high-intensity exercise programs seem to lead to a faster decrease in pain and disability than low-intensity programs. Karagee et al., in a prospective review of 50 consecutive patients undergoing first-time lumbar discectomy for disc herniation, demonstrated that lifting of postoperative activity restrictions after limited discectomy allowed shortened sick leave without increased complications. He concluded that postoperative precautions in these patients may not be necessary. Moving on to the next question. A 38-year-old man reports a 2-week history of acute low back pain with radiation into the left lower extremity. There is no history of trauma and no systemic signs are noted. Examination reveals a positive straight leg test at 35 degrees on the left side and a contralateral straight leg raise on the right side. Motor testing demonstrates mild weakness of the gluteus medius and weakness of the extensor hallucis longus of 3+ out of 5. Sensory examination demonstrates decreased sensation along the lateral aspect of the calf and the top of the foot. Knee and ankle reflexes are intact and symmetrical. Radiographs demonstrate no obvious abnormality. MRI scans show a posterolateral disc herniation. The diagnosis at this time is consistent with the herniated nucleus pulposus at, and the choices are 1, L12, 2, L23, 3, L34, 4, L45, and 5, L5S1. So the patient's history and physical examination findings are consistent with a lumbar disc herniation at the L4-5 level. Weakness of the extensor hallucis longus and gluteus medius are consistent with an L5 lumbar radiculopathy. Nerve root tension signs are also consistent with sciatica from a lumbar disc herniation. The MRI scans confirm a posterolateral disc herniation at L4-5, which typically affects the traversing L5 nerve root. So the correct answer to this question is 4, L4-5. Moving on to the next question. 6 weeks after onset, what is the most clearly accepted indication for surgical management for lumbar disc herniation? And the choices are 1, stable sensory loss, 2, stable motor weakness, 3, refractory radicular pain, 4, size of the herniation, and 5, lost time at work. So in the absence of a cauda-equina syndrome or progressive weakness, the best indication for surgical management is refractory radicular pain. Surgical decision-making should not be based on the size of the herniation. Large extruded herniations tend to resolve more predictably than smaller herniations. Stable motor weakness and numbness resolve similarly in both surgical and non-surgical management, although surgery hastens the process. When intractable radicular pain is the strict indication for surgery, surgical intervention provides substantial and more rapid pain relief than non-surgical care. So the correct answer to this question is 3, refractory radicular pain. Moving on to the next question. Surgical treatment for symptomatic disc herniations is associated with which of the following? And the choices are 1, substantial rate of nerve root injury, 2, early relief of pain sustained out to 2 years, 3, recurrent herniation rate of 35%, 4, outcomes that are substantially worse than non-surgical management, and 5, 10% rate of infectious discitis. So the recently published SPORT trial verifies that surgical treatment of symptomatic disc herniations is associated with early and sustained pain relief. So the correct answer to this question is 2, early relief of pain sustained out to 2 years. The trial also verifies that non-surgical management is associated with improved symptoms as well. Nerve root injury, recurrent herniation, and discitis are known complications of surgery, but all are less common than described above. And moving on to the final question for this topic. The 5-year outcome for patients with sciatica secondary to lumbar disc herniation shows which of the following results. And the choices are 1, patients have the same likelihood of receiving disability whether treated with or without surgery. 2, 60% of surgically treated patients undergo at least one more operation within 5 years. 3, only 20% of patients treated with surgery report improved symptoms of back and or leg pain. 4, a smaller portion of surgical patients compared to non-surgically treated patients report improvement. And 5, 50% of patients treated non-surgically seek surgery within 5 years. So Atlas and Associates, in the main lumbar spine study, reported that overall, patients treated initially with surgery reported better outcomes. By 5 years, 19% of surgical patients had undergone at least one additional lumbar spine operation, and 16% of non-surgical patients had opted for at least one lumbar spine operation. At the 5-year follow-up, 70% of patients initially treated surgically reported improvement in their predominant symptom, that is either back or leg pain, versus 56% of those initially treated non-surgically. They also noted that there was no difference in the proportion of patients receiving disability compensation at the 5-year follow-up. So the correct answer to this question is 1, patients have the same likelihood of receiving disability whether treated with or without surgery. That's all for this question review session about TKA prosthesis design and lumbar disc herniation. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.